Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz on episode 186. We are in November. It is post-Fed Jubilation Day. It is a wondrous time when money is now being scattered all about the world through the magical process of printing money. We'll talk about that today. And we're also going to bring on Robert V. Green to talk about some very interesting topic that I would love to hear more about, because this whole area of the broadband integration, the broadband stimulus, it really has not been played out so much, and I haven't seen a lot of written about it. But he wrote a great report on it. We've been talking about it for some time. We'll get to that in a minute. But obviously, the thing that we need to discuss is Bernanke and gang. We need to discuss the Republicans taking the majority in the House and a nice piece in the Senate and a lot of governor races throughout the country. You know, the big question was, you know, is this a direct blow to the Obama administration? The Democrats that were sitting in the House had the majority in both the House and the Senate over the last couple of years. And what you would seem to believe is now a failed policy initiative. I mean, from the look of the stock market, you wouldn't say there was a failed policy initiative. But then you look at Main Street and there's a much different situation. This is what they were going after at the whole time. Remember the whole Main Street versus Wall Street way back when President Obama was originally campaigning. And then all of a sudden we saw that Main Street stayed in the gutter and Wall Street really did very, very well. Bonuses are going up. Stock prices are going up. You know, not on everything, but generally speaking, the trend has been a little bit up and down. But right now we're seeing that obviously over the last year and a half, that the trend has been generally up after that gigantic drop we saw in the banking crisis of 2008-2009. So the question is, what are people so upset about? Well, clearly they're upset because the unemployment rate is it hasn't moved. I mean, it hasn't gotten any better. Initial claims are still showing a 450 plus. Unemployments are going to come in, They say at least close to 10% for the next, I don't know, foreseeable future. And right now, the Republicans are in talking about $100 billion cut to expending and spending programs, talking about actually repealing health care, which will create an unbelievable mess, in my opinion. Uncertainty and a mess. We'll see how that plays out. But, you know, at least there's something in there right now that we could say is there, whether it's good or not. The time when they start to repeal it, it's going to cause all sorts of problems. It's going to cause a lot of people, companies, to start wondering, what do we do from here? Just like what happened with the postponement of the vote on the Bush tax extension, whether or not it's going to happen or not. This week, President Obama said that, you know what, now he's kind of in favor of an extension for everyone. That happened, I think he mentioned that on Thursday, the day after Bernanke came out with a $600 billion purchase of treasuries over the next 10 months or so, And he decided that the next foreseeable future, $250 to $300 billion, would be continually repurchased of expiring mortgages. Now, let's put this in perspective for a second for everybody that wants to understand what this all means. Well, from the aspect of the stock market in the world, it obviously means a lower dollar, at least at this point, at least that did push down the dollar to a very low point, lowest point it's been for a while. Even though right after the announcement, the dollar did pop up, bonds actually were sold off dramatically on the long end of the curve, and markets kind of initially went down about 1% and then followed up the end of the day about up very just slightly. 0.2% or something like that by the end of the day, 0.3% by the end of the day on Wednesday. Thursday comes around and the whole world is just, wow, look at that. Bernanke's coming in and doing everything they can, throwing in the kitchen sink, etc. Bottom line, all it did was really affect the interest rates slightly on the interim term, the midterm of the interest rate curve, the 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 year bonds, and at the same time drop the dollar. I don't know why the dollar dropped on that number. In fact, I could say that the dollar should have risen a little bit on that number because of the fact that we are seeing the dollar probably moved up too much to begin with, and at the same time the number was a little bit shy what everybody thought. The $600 billion is going to be done over a monthly period, and he's not even hitting the long end of the curve. The whole idea was to reduce down interest rates as best as possible so that people could buy homes, et cetera, and have a better opportunity to refinance. The problem is refinancing and loans aren't really happening that much, although they've been picking up of late. And at the same time, you know, when you look at the housing market, the confusion with the foreclosure issue, with the banking mortgages, et cetera, is not providing the impetus for anybody to go out and really buy a house. Now, at the same time, when we look at this, you would have expected the long end of the bond, the one to be purchased, the 20, 25, 30 year, which is the mortgage side. That didn't really happen. He's talking about the 5 to 6 year level range. Now, how in the world is that going to help unemployment? Tell me, explain to me, anybody, if you believe, if you have any ideas, if you can give me an inch of information, just a smidgen, of how reducing interest rates lower than they are today, right here, right now, on the short end, 0 to 25 basis points, and the 10-year, I think, hit a all-time low in interest rate. The 7-year also, I think the 10-year is getting closer, it hit already. How in the world is that going to help employment? I don't see it. Give a tax credit to business, okay, I can see that. Give an employee tax credit. You know, in other words, you know, for this many employees, if you hire, you get a tax credit. But how in the world is this going to actually give the employers the impetus to, in fact, hire? Let's go one step further. The amount that the basic comment that there was going to be some additional quantitative easing being done by Bernanke about a month ago, the amount that we have seen copper and a variety of materials, softs, in other words, the grains, sugars, go up is remarkable. Input pricing has gone up. You could tell me anything that you want. It's true. Input pricing has gone up. Oh, but Andrew, you know, the CPI is still zero with a negative and deflationary and blah, blah. Listen, look at the numbers. Tell me where that it all falls out. The food prices, the agricultural prices, the materials prices in general is definitely rising substantially. Now, if employers who use those materials know this and they see the same demand right now, are they going to hire more people? Probably not. So what does that mean? I think right now what that means is that the hope is, and really the word hope I use seriously, the hope is that the idea of inflation is going to cause people to rush out and buy something now because they believe that the price is going up in the future, the opposite of deflation. So let's take a car. If we believe that prices of cars are going up over the next few months, will we actually go out and buy a car now? Will that spur you on to buy a car? Perhaps it would in good times when you're employed and when you have the excess money coming in, and you could just go ahead and buy a car if you want to. But when people aren't such, the masses now, are in such a necessity-based time, when in fact they are buying on a need to have basis, kind of an immediate need to have basis, very close to the time that they need it versus buying things in advance, I question how much that's going to help. Will it help? Well, I'll tell you something. Prices have been going up. We have seen a variety of companies. UPS this week announced that their prices are going up. Starbucks a few weeks back announced that their prices are going up. We've seen several different companies and various areas saying, like, for example, the materials company saying that they're going to start, aluminum, they're going to start raising prices. Steel, they're going to do their best to raise their prices. And this is going on and on and on and on. We're seeing these price raises. Now, that being the case, you have to wonder, is that going to add to PPI or CPI? We talked about this the last few weeks. PPI has been going up. But in the end, because they are devaluing, debasing the currency in the U.S., gold went up 2.5% the day after. We saw silver moving up to record, you know, recent highs. We've seen that stocks have moved up. But remember something. The value of the dollar went down. They are going right against what they talked about at the G20. And frankly, it's a bit perturbing. Because, you know, during the G20, which was a toothless nonsense of a meeting, which said that, hey, there will be no competitive currency devaluations. Bull. This was a currency devaluation, and that's why they did it here. Other countries around the world are going to be hurt by this, and they're going to do something about it. We already talked that India and Australia last week increased their base discount rate because they're afraid of inflation hitting in because of the low value of the dollar and all the liquidity that's coming to the markets. We've seen also countries like Brazil. We've seen countries throughout Asia also having a spiking inflationary rate, ex-Japan, of course. And Japan, I don't know what's wrong with them, but it seems like they really should do some extreme, shocking level of buyback of the dollar and selling off the yen at this point because they are just getting killed. They're getting killed. Yeah, the yen lifted a little bit off of its level off of 80 and change to 81 and 50 or so, but then it just fell right back. 85 is the magic number we want to see or more on the yen. All that aside, still, stocks continue to do well. Volume has been picking up a little bit on some of the days. That's good news. But surprisingly, we've also seen some decent earnings. Is this all because of the Republicans right now? No. It's because the Republicans, in fact, I'll share something with you. If you look at the election day results, the actual markets were down throughout the day until Bernanke came on at 2:15 with the confirmation of what he was going to do, which was right in line with expectations of about $1 trillion total, broken up into two parts of, I don't even want to call it stimulus, of money printing. Now, what if we see the debt limit, well, maybe not decreased, but held and no longer allowed to increase under the Republicans? What if we see $100 billion of cuts in services? What if we see all this? Well, right now there's a floor under the market. I think everybody believes that. Because as things get worse, if things get worse, well, Bernanke will pull out a magic couple of bucks and throw it in there. If things get better, well, there won't have to be so much done in the name of, you know, pushing on the economy. But I'll tell you something. What I really found the most interesting of all, and we'll end on this point on this, is that it looked like the economy was starting to stabilize in a lot of ways. In other words, we saw manufacturing generally doing a little bit better. Not all of them, but mostly the ISM manufacturing numbers do a lot better here. We saw unemployment starting to kind of get a little bit of, gain a little ground. We're seeing also various economics look a little bit better. Corporate earnings are doing a little bit better. Revenues looked a little bit better on the overall S&P companies that reported. Clearly, EPS was doing pretty well. And it looked like investor appetite has been returning, not as skittish as it's been. Put that all into place and the fact that we see some of the global numbers, and it's almost like they decided not only to gas up the tank but put the nitrous oxide into the car and push the button repeatedly with this latest round of, again, I can't call it stimulus, money printing. Well, we're going to end on that and bring up our next guest. And then I'll mention that we'll have some more questions answered next week by listeners. If you want to ask anything to me, send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And for the last couple of weeks, we've been teasing that we were going to bring back on Robert V. Green, investment strategist over at briefing.com, who wrote a great piece, a rather in-depth discussion about the National Broadband Plan. And he calls it the Cloud Computing Spark Plug with a question mark. So I know that that's of interest to many of you, talking about what is going on with this whole idea of the cloud. Some of you may still not know what the cloud is all about and if it's something that's going to actually last or if it's just a little flash in the pan. So I thought we would do this. This is actually a research piece done by Briefing and their research subscription. It's a special high-end subscription that you can get over at briefing.com. You know, I talk about them a lot because I really enjoy the work they do there, and particularly from Robert V. Green here. What is the story? Tell us. Hey, Bob, how are you doing, by the way?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Yeah, so we talked back and forth about this. I know you got back from a little vacation recently. Hopefully you're well-rested. The National Broadband Plan. This was something that was initiated through the stimulus package, right?
It was part of the mandate of the stimulus package, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. And one of the directives to the FCC was to develop a national broadband plan. If you remember, one of the goals of the stimulus package was to rebuild the infrastructure. And a lot of people think infrastructure just means the highways and bridges in this country, but Congress viewed it also including the electrical infrastructure, including the electricity grid that's across the country and the telecommunications network, which is the most advanced in the world. And part of the National Broadband Plan was to keep it the most advanced in the world. And so the FCC was directed to come up with a plan, which they did back in April, and it has been up for debate since that time with some additional expansion on it and comments on it.
Yeah, one of the things, when I read through this report, and I talked to a couple of people about the concept of some of the overriding issues that came up, it ended up having, when I finished it and I put it down, this Big Brother approach to it, or the Big Brother thought that I was like, wow, wait a minute. The FCC now goes from a regulatory body almost to a sales what would you say? It's definitely changing the dynamic of what the FCC does, right?
That's how I feel. I mean, the direction of the industry is clearly something the FCC now wants to control. They want to push the telecom industry in the direction of their vision of the National Broadband Plan.
Mm-hmm.
That's a political shift over recent years, although the FCC and government, both Democrats and Republicans, have viewed the telecommunications industry as a semi-social property since the 1981 breakup of AT&T. There was this thinking for years and years that the telecommunications system built by AT&T when it was a monopoly should be viewed as partially owned by the public because of that monopolistic ownership. And so during the breakup, the government regulated local phone calls, allowed more competition in long-distance phone calls. But then when we had the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the government began to open up the access to local networks owned by the regional Bell operating companies, mm-hmm. as they were called, RBOCs. Right. They began to open that to anyone at regulated rates so that you could start your own company and be able to use their network without having to build your own. And that thinking is, I don't want to call it socialist because it was still up to individuals to decide whether they should start a business that could access this already existing network without any investment of capital. I don't want to call that socialist, but it's pretty close to it in a way.
Well, in that you're going to be buying your product from the government.
Well, from a private entity such as Verizon. Verizon and AT&T, which used to be SBC, those are the only two real remaining RBOCs, and they had to allow outside companies access to their system at the local level to, at regulated rates by the government, whether they wanted to or not. They were forced to by the government. And that sort of view that the telecommunication networks is a really totally private property, that it's somewhat public property that the government can regulate, that view was really established in the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and the National Broadband Plan goes another step further by envisioning what metrics should be used for development of the industry. I mean, it's incredibly bold in its vision.
And obviously this, you know, we know the FCC has already tried to do what they can on net neutrality to a point of stepping aside and trying to usurp the rules, the laws, and the position that was taken on net neutrality, and then trying to go the backdoor route to make it so that it was their way anyway.
Yeah, I think that net neutrality is here to stay, and the ruling of Comcast versus the FCC, which basically said that Comcast has the right to restrict traffic on their portion of the internet, the portion that they own, I don't think that that ruling is going to destroy the concept of net neutrality. I mean, basically, at its core, net neutrality is the idea that no one can set up a toll road on the total internet. In other words, the internet is a giant system that is owned by multiple people, and certain key core elements of it are owned by private organizations, and the deal since the beginning of the internet was that I won't charge you to access your portion if you won't charge me to access my portion. I won't charge you to access my portion if you won't charge me to access your portion.
Right.
But that later became, the free market came upon that idea itself in the 70s and the 80s. And then in the 90s, when it boomed, the FCC, in order to encourage the growth of the internet, made a ruling that net neutrality had to stand. Now, the National Broadband Plan goes way beyond the net neutrality idea.
Right.
I mean, it sets metrics. It basically views internet broadband access as not only a American individual right, but something that the government has to ensure happens. And that's a big step.
And let's back it up for a second, because let's talk about some of the things before the net neutrality and all the specifics involved, but some of the summaries that you have come up with and some of the goals and very, very, I don't know, I mean, some of these goals seem a little silly to me. For example, you write down that 7 million households out of 110 million households are not receiving broadband service. Now, that's, let's call it 6% round number, okay? That doesn't seem like a big number of households that don't have broadband because they possibly have a lot of reasons why they don't have broadband.
Well, they may not want to buy it.
I mean, simple as that, right? They're happy with the, you know, welcome to AOL stuff. But what is, I really feel
they might not own a computer.
It could be, could it be a secondary home? Could it be a home possibly that's not being, I mean, there could be a lot of different reasons for this. And that seems to be a margin of error number to me rather than something that's a concerning. But what you said is that the National Broadband Plan has goals. One of the current goals is to bring 100% of internet availability and broadband service, not internet availability, excuse me, broadband service, because there's a difference.
Yep.
To households by 2015 with an adoption rate of give or take 90% of that. So everybody can get it. A good amount of people are going to adopt it. And the 2015 goal is for a 50 megabit download and 20 megabit upload. Okay, so that right there is interesting. They're going further and saying that in 2020, 100%, 90%, and 100 megabit download, 50 megabit upload. That is kind
correct.
Of, I found that to be very interesting because there's a lot of different measures of what broadband is. Right now, the idea is that broadband is 4 megabits down, 1 megabit up.
That's how the FCC is defining broadband. And most of the cable offerings, cable modem offerings, and fiber optic offerings, they all meet that. That's like the lowest entry level. And even at that definition, as you said, we've got 94% coverage. That's not people who've signed up.
Right.
Right now we have approximately two-thirds of the people of the households in the U.S. have signed up for broadband. Two-thirds. It's really quite astonishing penetration. I can remember just 10 years ago, it was people were saying, why isn't it being adopted more quickly? And without a lot of hype and media buzz and stock market buzz, people have been signing up. So we've got two-thirds of the country covered right now.
Well, what's interesting about it is that two-thirds. Now, I find that to be very astonishing in that it seems incredibly low for where we are today. And I don't think that just that, I mean, do you think that because they push the speeds to 50-20 or 150 on the up and down, that that's going to do something? No, it's just it's a slow and steady process, because 95% availability seems to me to be as close enough to 100 to be splitting hairs.
Right. And so what you're saying is something I agree with, which is we have 95% availability, which is in the industry they use the term homes covered. That comes from the cable TV. That means you can get it if you want it. 95% availability of all the homes in the country have broadband availability at 4 megabytes per second download. And we have 65% adoption rate. That's 65% of all homes, not, you know, not to split hairs, but not 65% of 95%. So there's 30% of people in this country for whom broadband access is available, and they choose not to buy it.
Right.
Why? It could be they don't have a computer. They're older people. You know, I mean, my parents have it available. They don't know how to work the computer, so they don't have broadband access. But one of the goals is to, one, make it 100% available. That's one kind of goal. I can see pushing for that. We do have 100% availability for telephone access in this country right now.
But now, let me just back up. Yes, we do have that, but the fact is we also have the reality that a lot of people are disinheriting or taking their availability and saying, we don't want a phone anymore because we have cell phones. I mean, the truth of the matter is that take yourself back 100 years when phones were starting to be, you know, whatever year it was, starting to really create significant penetration, that it was always available. You can grab a phone in your home. And if you had the choice at that time, exactly at that time, between a telephone that was mounted to your wall or a cell phone at that time, what do you think the adoption rate would be? A lot lower, right?
Well, I agree.
So now you have the choice right now of having internet availability in your home, or you have 3G and 4G phones that basically also have, and iPads and things like that that have that as well. So is it possible that the adoption rate that they're basing this on should be based on a per-person issue, not on a per-home issue?
That's interesting. I don't think they really get into that. They view it. I think they're behind the times. They think of broadband as wired, cable and fiber optic. And what they're hoping for in 2020 in this plan is 100% availability and 90% adoption rate with an download speed of 100 megabytes per second and an upload of 50 megabytes per second. That's astonishingly fast.
Yep.
And I think that they're viewing it as, you know, part of the stimulus plan is build the infrastructure. And they're saying, let's view this as the build out of the interstate highway system in the 50s, where if you go back and read about the introduction of that, people said, this is incredible waste. Who's going to drive all this distance?
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
They didn't. Why do we need two lanes in each direction? That kind of thing. The vision of the interstate highway did build commerce, helped build the economy in the 1950s. It definitely changed the face of distribution and opened markets for other people. And I think the FCC is viewing broadband in the same way. Whether that's accurate or not, I don't know. But the vision is building the infrastructure. So they set these really lofty goals.
Right.
It boils down to the issue of you can lead a horse to water, but can you make them drink? If they force the industry to build the infrastructure to the level of 100 megabytes download available for every single household in this country, will they get enough subscribers to recover the capital that's required to build that capacity? I'm somewhat skeptical.
I'm skeptical also. But here's some other interesting things. Let me just give you some specs from this report that I think were really fascinating. You had an adoption issue. You know, we talked about how many people adopted, where they're adopted from, you know, in terms of the adoption rate of the broadband, et cetera. Here's adoption by income. I thought these kind of were very telling. I'm not sure what they told, but they were telling about something when you added them all together.
I was struck by it as well.
Yeah, so adoption by income, less than $20,000, only 40% of, again, back to that 95% availability, only 40% were adopting to get the broadband, whereas it slowly crept up to 93% at 75,000 plus. Now, adoption by ethnicity is white was 69%, African American was 59%, Hispanic 49%. And also the adoption by education. I thought this one especially was kind of interesting because no high school degree. Now these are adults, of course, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we're not talking about like a 3-year-old. I mean, obviously, I'm just pointing that out. You know, of course, a 3-year-old is not going to have it. So no high school degree was 24%. High school degree 55%. Some college 77%, and a college degree 86%. And then adoption by what area you lived in, it was urban 68%, rural 50%. And finally, the adoption by age, 18 to 29, 75%, 30 to 49, 74%. Pretty much 18 to 49 was about 75%, which you would expect because that's the people that were brought up during the internet genesis, if you will.
Learning computers isn't something new for them. So
right.
Internet is – some of them don't know the era – before computers and internet existed.
Yeah, I try to explain to my kid what an encyclopedia is. He goes, That's stupid.
It's right. Old-fashioned.
Let me get this straight. You went somewhere, you read what it said in the encyclopedia that could have been like a year or so old, and you would use that information. And then furthermore, you would use this thing called, what do you call it, microfilm, microfiche, that you would go back and look at older information on it. Why in the world would you do something like that to try to do a report?
Well, for the first, I can answer that. The effort to create that stuff tended to make the information more reliable, but that's a whole other topic for another time.
Oh, yeah, you have the questions about reliability, no question. But, the funny thing is nobody cares about that. They think that if it's in print, it is reliable and vetted, which we know is not to be the case.
True.
And then finally, just back to this adoption by age, we said that 18 to 49 is 75%. 50 to 64, 64%, and 65 and older, 35%. That makes total sense to me, okay? What I don't understand is the disparity between the adoption by education. Do you?
Don't understand in the sense that the level should be
a little bit more
higher
compressed.
Yeah,
a little bit more compressed. It just seems like that no high school degree, what's the difference if you want to get email? Now, is it because maybe college degree? I mean, the theory is, I'm just talking out loud here.
I mean, you could draw a correlation with income as well, because if you're an adult and you don't have a high school degree, you're not making a lot of money, right?
Okay.
So
okay.
Broadband might be something that you might do your email entirely with texting on a cell phone, you know, what we think of as email. Or you might have broadband, or you might have email access at less than 4 megabytes per second. This is broadband access only, not internet access. How many people are still dialing in, I don't know, but there are some people. You see ads for it occasionally on TV still at incredibly low prices. So I think it's a negligible part of the internet population, but it may exist. I don't have data on how many people have dial-up access still. But the education level, I would say it probably correlates with income levels, so that people who have college degrees make more, and therefore they're more likely to have it. For example, I mean, it's the same price for everybody, no matter how much money you make, right? So the percentage of your total income to have broadband in your house is a lot smaller the more money you make. It's 93% adoption for people for households that have more than $75,000 a year. I'm actually impressed that 40% of those earning less than $20,000, that's the poverty line, 40% of people in poverty have broadband access.
Yeah.
That's the number that astounds me. It's like, hey, we're doing pretty well in this country. Yet that it's obviously something that people value enough to spend, to make the decision to spend, when that spending decision is a very hard thing to do. Probably have health care insurance less than 40% for people who make less than 20,000.
Well, let's talk about what really is now a couple of things. Let's talk about something that is irking me, and I got to get it off my chest about this. And then let's talk about who some of the potential winners are and where the direction of this could be and can be. I thought we'd see this actually move ahead a little bit faster. First of all, let me say two things. Number one, it does seem to most Americans that we have a great internet plan and things are good, generally speaking, and we have internet access everywhere and great cell phones and all that. But my God, we are so far behind the most of the rest of the developing, especially developing world, it's not even funny. Right?
I'm not sure we're... It depends on who you compare yourself to.
Well,
we're still ahead of China.
We're ahead of China, but we're still, in much of the world, the broadband speeds and the access is obviously... I think the access we have and the availability is better here, but where they have the speed and all that, there it's better, plus their cell phone networks are better.
And it depends on who you make the comparison to, because the United States is unique in a number of ways. First of all, the geographical size of the United States and the diversity. I mean, there are areas where you go out west in the desert areas down in Arizona and New Mexico and Utah. It's a long way between towns, and some of those towns, it's real hard to get internet access to. Those numbers show up in these statistics. In New York City, you've got multiple choices of people to subscribe to at the highest possible rates. So it sort of depends on where the markets are. I mean, if you take a developing country I don't think Korea is developing anymore. I think they are developed. But yeah, internet access and wireless access is everywhere. But they're a much smaller country, and they are very dense populations, so that you can have a market for your capital investment of significant size to make it worthwhile to upgrade all the time. Out in Arizona, you have to think twice about upgrading to 3G once you built the cell phone network. Who's going to subscribe? I mean, it costs to build capacity, and you need paying customers to recover that cost. What the FCC is envisioning is forcing people to build that capacity by reallocating profits. For example, they want to take the Universal Service Fund and reallocate that to broadband development. Now, the way the Universal Service Fund works now and has for 80 years is we've taxed long-distance calls. This is how it originated. We taxed long-distance calls and used the extra money to subsidize the development of telephone service by rural telephone providers. That's how we got 100% coverage of telephones in pre-World War II and right after World War II. They want to reallocate the Universal Service Fund, keep it in place, a tax on all phone calls, and make it subsidies to build broadband capacity by rural broadband providers. That's part of this plan. Congress would have to approve that. The FCC doesn't have authority to make that change themselves, although one of the proposals in this plan is that Congress give the FCC authority to allocate the money without congressional approval. Doubt that's going to happen, but that's how they plan to do it, with the Universal Service Fund.
But what about, is that also going to cover what they said, that if you can't afford broadband, we are going to partially pay, we're going to offset, we're going to give you credit, we're going to give you some kind of a, I don't know, I guess it's would be part of welfare. Welfare, you get a welfare check and you get a welfare broadband check?
That is a separate fund that they want to introduce, which is the Universal Service Fund subsidizes private companies investing capital to create the capacity. They've also proposed the idea, although they haven't proposed a particular fund, that we somehow provide government assistance to homes that can't afford broadband so they can afford broadband at the rates that the FCC is talking about.
I find that under the current, well, let's just say, where are we today? So the former regime that was in Congress, et cetera, that would be acceptable. Under the new regime, I question whether that's going to be released.
I would tend to agree with you. I think when this plan was written, the idea was closely linked to the idea of health care. In other words, everyone deserves health care, and we have to have health care of a certain idea, a certain level, available for everyone. The broadband plan mimics that in a way, saying that high-quality broadband has to be available and affordable for everyone has to be included. I mean, if you look at the adoption statistics you just mentioned, the minority ethnicities and lower-income households are the ones that lag urban wealthy households. What a surprise. They lag. I'm sure new car sales follow the same pattern. Wealthy urban people own more new cars than lower income households. But they don't view broadband as similar to car ownership. They view it as a right, the way they view telephone access as a right. And it's not just availability, but affordability.
Let me tell you something. First of all, I think that everybody should have a pair of comfortable shoes. I think that everybody should have a Mac, for that matter, and I think it's the right because it really does enhance your life and it creates a lot of additional benefits for you, et cetera. But like you said, that's just what their vision is right now. I will say there is a significant difference between a car, a pair of shoes, and a Mac in that one thing. That if everybody had, and if this ubiquitous plan of providing internet broadband is adopted by the majority. Now, we're not talking about just the fact that you have dial-up, because dial-up's not always on. Let's add that to the equation, the concept of always on, okay? That always on, high-speed internet, at every single, let's just pretend for a moment, every single household in the United States, and it is managed and it is overseen by the government. This is where my big brother came into me, okay? And if they're going to allow for all this information flow, it does seem to me that they're going to then have access to the information flow, at least at some level, for monitoring, for understanding what your patterns are on the internet, for also for tracking when they include things like adding all your medical records and all your information online. And it will be available so that there is a much greater availability and ability for the government to understand who each and every individual citizen is. Now, that may sound very wide to the, crazy standpoint to some, but it just seems to me the way that they're pushing this and preparing this and putting this together, when they talk about this in your report, you talk about a lot of these things, about the FCC's rules, and some of the people that that have to have this, et cetera, it does seem that there is some kind of a flavoring for that. Don't you think so?
There's nothing explicit about that in the plan, but I certainly understand and can sympathize with that point of view. The FCC is clearly stating that they view the National Broadband Plan as sort of their territory to control, shape, and influence, not just regulate a free market, where people, where private entities make the decision whether they're going to invest capital, what kind of services they're going to provide. It's much more interested, here's what you must do. It's a very short step to them saying, here's what you must provide as content. It's a very short step. It's not to be fair, it's not in the plan right now, but I can see where those kind of concerns are valid because of the broad-reaching nature of the plan today. I do agree also with you, however, that I think the current administration that just got elected, the House representative being controlled by the Republicans now, I think the National Broadband Plan is going to be put on the hook for a while
at least be a little
even
bit
just stalled. Yeah. I mean,
so some of the companies that would benefit from this, I mean, you know, the companies like American Tower putting up the various towers, you have maybe Verizon, Comcast, and all these guys, I mean, that could benefit for this long term. You know, maybe a Corning for some of the fiber optics, you know, and things like maybe a Cisco and maybe an A Packet and maybe an F5 Networks and maybe, you know, all those various cloud computing plays that are being based on not just cloud, just the cloud, but infrastructure build out should be the play here, don't you think?
I think so, and I think also that you might want to consider looking at rural telecommunications providers. Even, you know, one of the biggest is Frontier, which bought local communication systems from Verizon for the Northeast, or something like Vermont Telecom, which is a long-standing local telephone service provider with no competition in most of Vermont. They might get subsidies from the National Broadband Plan to build broadband services. Will that make them have a higher return on their own investment in that area is the question that could be looked at. Anytime you can get free government capital, which is essentially what a subsidy is, it can be a benefit.
Right.
I'm a little bit skeptical because I think that the people in Vermont who already have broadband, getting it through DSL or one way or another, or from Comcast, which is pretty pervasive, are they going to switch? Are they going to, you know, become, how much of a market is there? That's what I would counter it with as an investor. I'd be very, very diligent about determining the size of the potential market. I wouldn't just go crazy from the idea that the government's going to give them free capital.
Did you have any breakdown that you did by state?
No, I haven't done a breakdown by state, but I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that the rural areas have less broadband adoption than densely populated areas.
So the plain states and things, I would tend to agree that plain states, maybe Alaska, although there is some, there's Igloo Telecom that...
Alaska's one of the ones. I did have some data. Alaska has better broadband distribution to its population than West Virginia.
And really?
It's probably based on income.
That's interesting.
It's probably based on income, right? I mean, and there's a lot of poor people in West Virginia.
Right. It's a mining state, and yeah.
People still living up in the hills, you know, in the Appalachian Hills. And the broadband, I'm forgetting the numbers off the top of my head, but there were significantly higher adoption rates in Alaska than in West Virginia.
Interesting. Well, you know, the bottom line on this is, and where the interest lies, is that we've seen the cloud computing, the infrastructure build out, the storage capability build out really be moving. This is a little different in that, you know, if broadband is going to become ubiquitous, that means that laying down cable, that means increasing the infrastructure, increasing the boxes all the way down to make sure the broadband capability can actually spill through from 1-4-10 megabit to, you know, 20-50-100. That's going to be, you know, opening that pipe up is going to be the job of the big companies and the big boys. And then as that happens, here's what's interesting and why we own a company like an A Packet, Acme Packet, we call it A Packet. And why we own this company is because they basically make session boards that are used with the internet, basically for voice over IP and video. Because if the idea is to create that much more bandwidth and utilize the bandwidth, well, then you got voice over IP that becomes much more reliable. You have television on demand much more reliable. You have video chat and chatting, it becomes much more reliable. So, you know, generally speaking, there is, this whole entire realm of change to the way we use the internet. You know, already that, you know, banking online and talking online. This call is a Skype call online that you and I are having. And, you know, essentially it becomes a much greater used device, not only, by the way, via the internet at your home. I'm hoping that a WiMAX proposal can come out of some sort that will allow for us to have internet on the road, which we do now with 3G and 4G, but I'm talking about something with substantial amounts of bandwidth that we won't have to pay for. Already the companies like Apple on their new plan are charging you extra with, I think it's greater than 2 gigabytes of download. And, you know, that's going to be troubling if you do it, that's on their network, you know, if you do it through their 3G. And that seems to be troubling to me, because what happens if you go over, and already they're starting to charge for that, which who knows if we'll get into that. So, but the infrastructure play seems to be something that is, I think, fascinating. I think the growth of, you know, the what can be done online as well. And from there, we'll have to see how this plays out. But a very interesting piece, and something that is available from briefing.com through their research subscription. And this is something that my friend here, Robert V. Green, has done a fantastic job at providing. And I want to thank you so much for this. Any final notes on really where you think this is going?
Well, I think, well, thank you, Andrew, for the compliment. But I also think that the build out of the internet infrastructure in the United States is going to happen whether the government directs it or not. And as a free market advocate, I would prefer to see the private sector figure out where it goes. But I think it's inevitable that we're still in the early days of this technology. It's far from maturing. And right now, it's primarily geared towards browsing with an internet browser. I'm waiting for the day when an entirely new aspect of interacting with digital data throughout the world occurs, whether that's video, whether it's multi-people conferencing, Skype does one-on-one, whether you can be a visible participant in gathering somewhere else, or you have
That's a Citrix, for example. That's a Cisco, as an example. They have those capabilities. But yet, at the same time, the cost factors for that kind of stream is expensive, and you're talking about doing it at a much better cost so that it's much more available for individuals and for small companies.
If there's any lesson we've learned from the technology over the last 50, 60 years, it's that the cost continually gets cheaper over time, and that spurs adoption terrifically.
Yep,
and
I agree.
Think with broadband, we're going to see that over the next 10 years, whether the FCC makes it happen or not.
And I, in closing on this point, I guess that we both have to chuckle at this, that 10 years ago, the discussion would be nowhere near this, right? And the incredible speed, more than, we're not talking about just Moore's Law here. We're talking about the incredible change to the internet experience that you and I deal with every single day, and how people have this relationship, whether it's a Facebook for the young folk, whether it's, you know, news, whether it's sports, whatever that is, emails, etc. The relationship we have with the internet, number one, and our computers. But number two, the incredible change that we've seen in 10 years, we could never imagine 10 years ago. Never.
You're absolutely correct. In fact, I've gone back and looked at some of the things I've written about broadband development. 10 years ago, people did envision the video era of the internet occurring overnight. You know, around 2000, at the very peak of the internet bubble, people expected it to happen overnight. Mark Cuban sold Broadcast.com to Yahoo for $6 billion at that time.
Nice.
Broadcast.com, you ever heard of it today? It never happened. It took 10 years for things like YouTube to come around. And I think that timing is essential to keep in mind. It's hard to envision something in the future, but it does happen. In retrospect, you realize it's happened very quickly.
Yeah, it happens right under your feet. I mean, you just go from a simple expansion of your download upload capability, it just may happen and you may not know it, but then you realize, wow, we doubled over the last year.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And it all happened by the free market making decisions on where it wants.
Yeah, I think it would be nice, I guess in closing, I think it would be nice if the government wants to give here, but I think these are one of the areas that free markets should be involved, because if the government gives and pushes, but yet the end result is not profitable for some reason for the free market, and the companies involved in it, then it's not going to work. They need to figure out a way to make it all work, whether it's through advertising, whether it's through paper plans, whatever it's going to pay for plans, whatever it's going to be. Because if the government just comes in and pushes this and just pushes this, you know, you may be, you know, like the old bridge to nowhere.
Well, I'm a big believer that the Telecommunications Act of 1966 had the direct result of allocating excess capital to build out the internet, which built the internet bubble in the stock market. And a lot of people lost a lot of money in that internet bubble, and some of those people have never recovered. That was 10 years ago. We like to talk about how people's 401k plans were ruined in the financial crisis of 2008. I think it was worse for certain people in 1999 and 2000 when the internet bubble collapsed. But that all happened by the government trying to make things happen. The government should just sort of create a level playing field and let people make their own decisions about how to allocate capital. It plays out best in the long run, I believe, but not everyone agrees with me politically.
I hear you. Robert V. Green from Briefing.com. We'll put a link on the site where you can find more from Briefing. You know, I really like all the writers there. We've become very, very close with many of the different analysts, et cetera. We share some information, et cetera. And I don't get paid by Briefing.com, by the way, just as a point of reference. But if you do want some great information, this is even a free, not only trial, it's a free freebie, something that Briefing's free, it's called, or something. There's different levels of information that you can get from them, from analysis and all that. Very much encourage you as one of the probably one of the top areas that I would look to for a news and might I say objective, I want to say objective, yeah, reviewing of the circumstance.
We do not manage money. We do not take money from companies for coverage. Our only point of view is that of our customers. That's the only place we receive revenue, and we try to give the best opinion that we can for our readers.
You know, I just thought of something, and we'll end with this. I think that everybody in the country should have Briefing.com, and I think the government should subsidize it.
Let's have the National Briefing Plan. I like that very much, Andrew.
All right, buddy boy. I'll see you soon, all right?
Always good talking to you.
All right, same here. I'll talk to you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
And we'll finish it right there, and great interview. Some good information out there. Again, if you have any questions at all that you want to ask me, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you're ready to invest, if you've been sitting on the sidelines for some time, maybe now is the time you're finally ready to do something. Also, there's something for you here over at The Disciplined Investor. What we do is we have a portfolio based on a lot of things we talk about here. We have many different types of portfolios that we run here at Horowitz & Company, from a minimum of $500,000 for those of you that are looking for a more diversified and balanced portfolio on a worldwide basis. We have our global allocations. For those of you that are looking for maybe a little bit more aggressive strategy with some short, long, etc., it is the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. $50,000 is the minimum there. All the information is on the show notes of this show. Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and just click on the button for a quick virtual tour. Gives you the ins and the outs and what we do and just a little bit more background, etc. Until next week, I'll see you soon. Have a great week. I wish you well. I wish you profits. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.